Madison, Wisconsin, March 25th, 2010. This Earth Day, shoppers can drop off old stilettos and loafers before purchasing new ones. East Town and West Town malls are excited to announce a partnership with Soles for Souls, a national shoe charity, now through Friday, April 16th. Shoppers will have the opportunity to celebrate Earth Day by recycling their gently worn shoes. The recent press release there from CBL Shopping Mall shows that the annual phenomenon known as Earth Day has traveled a long way since 1970, when Wisconsin's Gaylord Nelson initiated it. How much has it accomplished in those 40 years? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
To what extent were Gaylord Nelson and Earth Day responsible for launching the environmental movement? How accurate was Walter Cronkite when he described its proponents early on as predominantly young and white? What are the politics of Earth Day? And other questions. Well, our guest, Greg Mittman, will answer some, if not all of them. He's the interim director of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with the name of your institute, the Nelson Institute, and Gaylord Nelson himself, the man. Give us some sense about Gaylord Nelson, his background, and what led him to become the founder of Earth Day.
Sure. Well, I mean, Gaylord Nelson obviously had a very long political career in Wisconsin. He was born and grew up in northern Wisconsin in Clear Lake. His father was a physician there, and he was born in 1916. And it was a period of Wisconsin known as the cutover, so during the late 19th and early 20th century, where a lot of great northern white pines were harvested, clear cut, and it really led to a situation in which there was quite severe poverty and environmental degradation to which Gaylord Nelson was exposed to growing up as he was living through the Great Depression. And I think part of that experience of living in that degraded landscape certainly shaped a career that was be dominated by issues focused on environmental issues as well as issues of poverty.
Where does he first start following this environmental track? Is it before 1970?
Oh, long before 1970. He was a state legislature in the state during the 1950s, became governor in 1958 of Wisconsin. And as governor from 1958 to 1962, he became known as the conservation governor, really pushed forth some pioneer legislation that would really shape legislation in other states, particularly in 1961. He was successful in passing the Outdoor Recreation Act, which used a cigarette tax to really broaden the public lands in Wisconsin, improve the state parks, and create open space. So that was a really, really important piece of pioneer environmental legislation that he was involved in his governor's career.
Was he influenced by Aldo Leopold and some of the others like
Absolutely.
That?
He was very much influenced by Aldo Leopold, by Rachel Carson, by Joseph Wood Crutch, by many environmental writers of the 1950s and 60s. And when he became a U.S. senator in 1963, was really trying to push the Kennedy administration to take on the environment as a real cause of the Kennedy administration. And so he organized a national conservation tour with the Kennedy administration early on in Kennedy's presidential career that was not actually very successful. And then in 1966, he also tried to get a bill put forth in the Senate to ban DDT. This was coming off of Rachel Carson's 1962 Silent Spring.
Coming up, big story.
Exactly. And he couldn't get anyone to co-sponsor the bill with him.
Well, I would think he ran into some considerable opposition just in Wisconsin. I know that when that book, Silent Spring, was on Wisconsin Public Radio's Chapter a Day in 1968, all kinds of opposition came up to it. So I would think right on his home front, he would have run into a lot of strife.
Although one of the things that I think is really quite remarkable, and everyone that you talk to who knew Gaylord Nelson, he was very effective at bipartisanship. He was really able to bring people across the aisles from both the Republican and the Democratic side in these causes. And so even during the 1960s, as he was U.S. Senator, Governor Warren Knowles in Wisconsin, who was a Republican, continued to support environmental legislation in the state of Wisconsin. It was really through both Warren Knowles and Gaylord Nelson that they passed the Water Quality Act that, again, became a very important piece of legislation that other states model off of in terms of addressing issues around water pollution.
And while Gaylord Nelson was in the Senate, he was there for three terms, right?
Mm-hmm.
While he was in the Senate, what would he have said were the most pressing problems if he looked around him in terms of the environment? What bothered him the most?
Certainly issues around, he's very concerned with open space, public lands, wilderness, the kind of traditional, what we would consider as environmental issues of the 1950s and 60s. But one of the things that was very clear in Nelson's career is that he was also a major proponent of civil rights. Early on within the state legislature, really promoted the integration of Wisconsin National Guard, for example. And he was also a major advocate for Johnson's War on Poverty. So he was very concerned with issues around both the environment and also issues around poverty and social inequality. And he saw those as a piece. And so not only was he concerned about issues around public lands and wildlife and the state and national parks, but also in terms of issues around air pollution, water pollution, and the kinds of environmental and social issues that faced the nation's growing urban population.
What would the link have been in his mind between, let's say, poverty in inner city Milwaukee and the environmental movement? How did he link those?
In 1964, actually, he wrote a speech called Conservation in Our Cities, and it was very much shaped by the race riots that were happening around him. And it's quite striking in that piece where he speaks about how the conservation of our urban resources is as important as the conservation of our natural resources, and really saw the issues around poor housing, inadequate access to health care, and issues of disease, for example, in the inner city, as well as pollution within the inner city as well, that these were really creating environmental and social inequalities, which he saw as laying the foundation for the kind of race riots that were appearing in that summer of 1964.
Well, conservation is almost an old-fashioned term, I suppose, because it implies taking care of the status quo so that things don't get eroded further. Was he interested in conservation at this point, or was he interested more actively in reclaiming water and land that had been lost to pollution or some kind of misuse?
Well, absolutely. I mean, he was interested both in conservation and in, if you would say, reclamation or restoration. So there were a number of very, very visible kind of environmental catastrophes that he was witness to, obviously, in his youth during the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl, which some have described as the nation's largest environmental catastrophe. But particularly in the 1960s, 1950s and 1960s, with growing suburban sprawl and land getting eaten up by that, with increased air pollution as the automobile becomes the prominent way of American life, and, you know, particularly in Los Angeles and other big cities where you see it's a period where smog first really begins to become prominent as a very key environmental issue. And water, I mean, so in the late 1960s, when the Cuyahoga River in Ohio catches fire, I mean, here you have
kind of a clue, isn't it?
It is a clue that conservation wasn't going to be enough, that there needed to be remediation and restoration, as you said, Norman. And so he becomes very involved in environmental legislation that is aimed at promoting that.
And if you did a sort of a driving tour of Wisconsin today, what evidence would you find that Gaylord Nelson was there? In other words, what impact did it have here in the state?
Well, I would say certainly Wisconsin State Park System, which is, you know, quite wonderful. And the amount of state and public lands in Wisconsin is certainly a direct result of Gaylord Nelson's efforts. Certainly air quality in terms of the certain places in the state that, you know, I think we have seen a marked improvement in terms of air quality, also in terms of water quality in some ways, not so in others, since the 1950s and 60s. And all of those were a direct result of his work. Even the fact that DDT is no longer in use, eventually he did get support for a ban on DDT in 1972, and that's a direct result of his active work.
How did his focus change as he made that shift from governor of Wisconsin to senator from Wisconsin?
When he makes that shift from governor to senator, one of the things that we begin to see happen is a kind of new federalism that begins to take place in the 1960s, where the federal government becomes much, much more active in protecting the public interest around environmental issues. Largely before that, it had been driven by the states and state legislation. And so we really begin to see that, and particularly after Earth Day, where there becomes national environmental legislation that's enacted. And that's really a direct result of Gaylord Nelson's efforts.
That would actually be during the Nixon administration.
It was during the Nixon administration. That's correct.
And what kind of relationship did he have to some of the organizations like Nature Conservancy, Wilderness Society, and so on?
He was active in a number of environmental organizations. After his Senate career in 1980, he becomes chairman of the Wilderness Society, one of the largest national environmental organizations in the United States, and continues his work on really preservation of wild lands.
So when Gaylord Nelson was in the Senate, that obviously is the time at which he was working on Earth Day, getting that going. Where did he get the idea for having an Earth Day?
The idea for Earth Day came in 1969 when Gaylord Nelson was on a flight from he had been in Santa Barbara and to witness a major oil spill that had happened and again kind of galvanized public attention on the environment. There was a leakage of a oil drilling platform off the Santa Barbara coast and really polluted many of the beaches. And he began really thinking about how could he galvanize political attention around the environment? And obviously this was a moment of a period of really heightened student involvement in the anti-war movement, in which teach-ins were a common form of political organization and activism around the anti-war movement. And he thought of, what if we did a national teach-in day of the environment, much like the anti-war movement was doing in terms of teach-ins? And that's really where the idea first began.
About that same time, and maybe coincidental or maybe not, but in 1969, we start seeing the first images of the Earth from the moon. And that seemed to have really set off an awareness of how small and perhaps fragile and interconnected the Earth was.
Absolutely. And, you know, we began to see our place quite differently and to see this kind of small planet that we occupy. And that whole Earth image really became a prominent symbol of environmentalism post-Earth Day.
We're much more aware, it seems to me, of the Great Lakes now than we were 40 years ago. What did Gaylord Nelson have to say about the either conservation or reclamation of the Great Lakes?
Well, you know, as someone growing up in northern Wisconsin, the Great Lakes were very, very important to him, and obviously Lake Superior. And, you know, one of his other lasting legacies for the state of Wisconsin was the creation of the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. And that really came about through a tour he was on. I had mentioned he was on this national conservation tour with Kennedy, and they stopped up in the Ashland area. And as they were flying over that area, he pointed out sailboats to Kennedy. And Kennedy, who obviously was a great
sailor,
a very avid sailor, got quite interested all of a sudden in this area. And it was really through that that they were eventually able to pass legislation that established that area as a national lakeshore.
And what were some of his failures or frustrations? You mentioned, in fact, that the conservation tour with Kennedy was not a great success. But if you had asked Gaylord Nelson, what were you frustrated about? What did you fail at that you wanted to do? How would he have answered that?
Mm. You know, I think certainly during the 1960s, as he was a U.S. senator, many of the kinds of environmental issues that he was really trying to put forward failed. I mentioned, for example, in 1966, a ban on DDT. And it wasn't really until 1970 with Earth Day, which became such a success, that a lot of that kind of environmental legislation that he had been pushing for really took off. And so I think during the 1960s, in some ways, it was obviously a very heady time with Johnson's Great Society program and so forth. But in other ways, it's very clear from the correspondence that Nelson felt like he was a loner out there in terms of pushing federal legislation.
Do you think it got easier for him as awareness increased over the 60s and 70s and into the 80s? Or did it kind of vary in terms of the administration and how aware they were of the problems?
Well, I think it certainly got easier for him after Earth Day and during the 1970s. Obviously, in 1980, he lost his seat as U.S. senator. And with the coming into power of Ronald Reagan's administration, that was a significant hit on a lot of the kinds of environmental legislation that he had helped establish.
It's pretty amazing that Earth Day was the first Earth Day was the largest grassroots demonstration in American history, with 20 million Americans taking part. We're going to talk about that very first Earth Day when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
It's tremendously encouraging to see all across this country the remarkable interest on the campuses and off the campuses on an issue which is not only just an issue of survival, but an issue of how we survive. I don't think there's any other issue viewed in its broadest sense, which is as critical to mankind, as the issue of the quality of the environment in which we live.
Gaylord Nelson giving his first Earth Day speech in 1970 in Milwaukee and showing at that early point that he's linking not just the great outdoors, but also the inner cities and their plight to the cause of the environmental future of the country. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Greg Mittman, and we're looking at Earth Day 1970 and its legacy for us today. 22 million people involved in that first Earth Day back in 1970. That's quite an impressive number, but even Gaylord Nelson couldn't have done it alone. What kind of organizational structure did he have to build, and who were his allies in making it happen?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. It's 20 million people, one out of every 10 Americans, it's estimated, participated in Earth Day. And, you know, how do you pull off that kind of organizational feat, the largest really public demonstration in America? And Gaylord Nelson was adamant that it not be top down, that it not be orchestrated from a kind of centralized office and radiated outward. In fact, if you look at some of the documents, there was an attempt early on to do that, and he rejected it. And he would go on to say that kind of Earth Day organized itself. But he did, again, I mentioned that he was remarkable at bringing people from across the aisle together. And he had a Republican Congressman, Peter McCloskey from California, work with him in developing Earth Day. And they created a nonprofit organization, Environmental Teach-In Incorporated. And what they did was they hired students who had been very adept political organizers, some that had been involved in the anti-Vietnam War movement, others in the Chicano movement, and a range of students that had political organizational skills, in particular Dennis Hayes, who was a student from Stanford, was then a Harvard Law student, where they created a nonprofit based in D.C. that became a clearinghouse and a kind of informational center for communities and schools and colleges interested in organizing Earth Day events. And so although they sent out ideas, a lot of the events that happened were uniquely based in the campuses and the communities where it's happened. So there's an estimate about 10,000 public schools were involved, 2,000 colleges, and about 1,000 communities, all of which had very, very different expressions of what Earth Day meant to them.
And how was it billed to begin with? In other words, when Gaylord Nelson was trying to sort of sell the idea to schools or to fellow legislators, he would say Earth Day, it's a time to do what?
It's a time to really, you know, as he said, a teach-in. So it's a time to raise public awareness and political awareness about the plight of our planet and about the plight of the environment in which people were living, and really to try and galvanize national attention on this single issue.
It almost seems that there's a problem built in having just a day. In other words, if you have Earth Day, the danger would be to act as if it's something you can deal with in a day.
Absolutely. And I think that's something we might consider about, well, has it just become something like Valentine's Day?
Right.
Get a card and feel better.
Right.
Well, and even when you have a month, even if it's Black History Month, the danger is that you can come up with this sort of token programs, or, you know, let's do this little thing here and then we don't have to think about it the rest of the year. And there's a danger sort of built in sometimes to some of those events. How did Gaylord Nelson sort of try to make it so that a day-long event would have more lasting effects?
Well, it did. And when he first came up with this idea and when it was planned and then orchestrated, it's clear that he only ever thought of this as a one-time thing, that not that it would happen on a yearly basis.
Oh, so it just was going to be a one...
Right. It was a public demonstration that would really galvanize national attention on a single environment, on the environment as a major, major political issue, which over the decade, you know, he had tried to do in the U.S. Senate and had been somewhat unsuccessful. And after Earth Day in 1970, you know, we see this sweeping wave of national environmental legislation. So we have the new amendments of the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. We have the creation of the Endangered Species Act in 1973, the Marine Mammal Protection Act. We have the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency. All of that happened within 3 to 4 years after the original Earth Day. And so in that sense, it really succeeded in terms of what his goals were, was to really create this federal legislation that would become a really important means of protecting the environment.
And what were some of the activities, the hands-on things that took place on that first Earth Day? Was it cleaning up litter? Was it, you know, what did various schools and organizations do?
It was obviously things like cleaning up litter, planting trees. There was an act that received a lot of attention and controversy when students at San Jose State buried a brand new automobile signifying the death of the internal combustion engine. And what was interesting was that that act received a lot of critique from African-American students who, for example, saw this as an expression of white middle-class environmentalism, that the environment was really focused on kind of white middle-class issues and wasn't addressing the kinds of issues that poor people of color in the inner city were facing.
So they saw it the same way Walter Cronkite did on that first year. How valid was that critique?
Well, in some ways it was a valid critique and in other ways not. I mean, there were demonstrations that happened within urban areas, particularly among communities of color. So in St. Louis, for example, the Metropolitan St. Louis Black Survival Committee organized some events addressed around, for example, lead paint and poor housing and the kinds of issues that was creating for children growing up in the inner city.
You hear the word ecology. That's a big science, not a narrow one. It's a big concept. And it is concerned with all the ramifications of all the relationships of all living creatures to each other and their environment. It is concerned with the total ecosystem, not just how we dispose of tin cans, bottles, and our garbage. It is concerned with the habitat of marine creatures, animals, birds, and man.
So in some ways, it was true, in other ways not. And as we've talked about and as the clip showed, one of the things that Nelson was very concerned about and that he addressed in his Earth Day speech was that the environment wasn't just around issues around public land and open space and wildlife and things that we would consider more traditional kinds of conservation issues, but really was about issues around poor quality housing and disease and poverty in the inner city.
At what point did the 70s become the environmental decade? Because that did really become a phenomenon. There was something about the turning of the clock on December 31st, 1969, that suddenly everybody seemed aware, not just for a day, but of the decade.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because Earth Day is in some ways the beginning of a kind of modern environmental movement, but in some ways it's also the culmination. And in the 1950s and 60s particularly, we see a number of really important pieces of writing that start to galvanize public interest. Rachel Carson's Silent Spring in 1962, Paul Ehrlich's A Population Bomb in 1968, which becomes, you know, a national bestseller, galvanizing attention around population. And Nelson had a lot of concerns around overpopulation, for which he would later get critiqued. So during the 1960s, we see a real kind of wave of interest and activity. And then in the 1970s, when we have this federal environmental legislation that's established, that really sets off an environmental decade of sweeping legislative reform.
And how closely did Gaylor Nelson work with the scientific community? In other words, let's say you're having these events and you're trying to show that there's a problem with the water and the air and various things. Did he get scientists on board to try to help show the evidence?
Sure. And when Earth Day was established, they did have an advisory board that relied upon the scientific community and also informing that. So in terms of thinking about it as an environmental teach-in, drawing in scientists was important. And, you know, one of the sciences that Nelson promotes, and he talks about it in his first Earth Day speech, is ecology, which he saw as a really big science, as a science that really was able to integrate these issues together.
And was there interest abroad at all? In, you know, here's America having this Earth Day. Was there attention being paid in Europe and elsewhere?
The first Earth Day was primarily, my understanding is, within the U.S. I mean, in later iterations, it became much more international. And this year, it's estimated that about 180 countries will participate in some form in Earth Day events.
Well, the 1960s was also the time when birth control became a fairly easy option, you know, the advent of the pill in particular. And you mentioned a minute ago, Greg, that Gaylord Nelson, what shall we say, stepped on some toes with his attitude toward population control. How did that play out?
Well, I mean, you know, in the 1960s, overpopulation became one of the kinds of major cause celebs of the environmental movement, particularly following Paul Ehrlich's A Population Bomb. That had its critics, Barry Commoner being one, for example. And, you know, one of the questions was population, overpopulation, a cause of environmental problems? Or really, was it an outcome of the kind of economic and social status that people found themselves in?
He was sort of a maverick presidential candidate, Barry Commoner.
Yes, he was, and grew up, really cut his teeth, if you will, in terms of the environmental movement on working on issues around nuclear fallout. And he established the St. Louis Committee for Nuclear Information that was really bringing scientists and the public together to address atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons and really. In fact, many of the generation of the 1960s that participated in the first Earth Day movement, one of the things I think that why there is such environmental attention is they grew up with the fear of the bomb. And if you think about the opening of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, that opening chapter, she could just as well have been describing nuclear fallout as she could have been describing pesticides. And that was, I think, very conscious on her part.
What about the Catholic Church when we get to that issue of population, overpopulation, population control? Was that one of the opponents to Gaylord Nelson's thinking on the issue?
Well, certainly the Catholic Church was an opponent to the broader movement in terms of focusing on overpopulation. And in Paul Ehrlich's book, The Population Bomb, there's a sample letter that people could send in to the Pope critiquing that.
Fill out in terror and
right.
Send it in, huh?
But, I mean, one of the other concerns is, of course, too, is that overpopulation also merges into issues around immigration policy.
Sure.
And I think that's where it began to be seen as a very problematic issue, right, that you're closing access to people coming to the United States by focusing on needing to limit population, needing to limit growth.
Was that what Gaylord Nelson had in mind, to limit immigration?
Later on, he did, yeah. Invoke, you know, a stronger immigration policies in order to be able to address population issues. And that's where, you know, some of the, I think, heated controversy came.
What about his relationship to business? Because, I mean, these days often you have environmentalists kind of labeled as tree huggers or, you know, working to save a particular animal on a site, pitted against business interests, commercial interests, the economics of a particular thing. How did Gaylord Nelson and some of the early people involved in Earth Day try to bring businessmen into the discussion?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. The first Earth Day, two of the earliest sponsors of Earth Day were the United Auto Workers and the AFL-CIO. Nelson was a very big supporter and was able to win the support of the labor movement. So the kind of common stereotype of environment versus the economy or environment versus jobs is not something that Nelson adhered to. And he was very fond of saying that the economy is a subsidiary of the environment and that our economic growth and prosperity was really dependent upon nature's capital. And so if you were operating in a society that was destroying the environment, that was destroying the capital and resources upon which the economy was built, that eventually that would lead to economic collapse. And so I think he was really a coalition builder, you know, not only across both Republican and Democratic side, but among different constituencies within society and business people.
What did he suggest as an energy source for this country? We're just now getting to the first crises. If you're talking about 1973, for example, in oil supply for the United States.
Right.
Is he proposing alternatives for energy?
Well, he really advocated for the death of the internal combustion engine and looking to alternative technologies. Certainly is a proponent of energy efficiency and conservation as Jimmy Carter's administration becomes really prominent of. And in the 1970s, we see a real interest in alternative energy technologies, particularly around photovoltaics and wind and others that we're now seeing a kind of revived interest in.
What are some of the issues that have come along since that first Earth Day that stand out in your mind?
Well, to my mind, you know, I think in some ways we're really coming to terms with the kinds of issues around environment and social justice that were certainly of interest to Gaylord Nelson and are particularly around urban environmental issues. So we know from between now and 2050, 3 billion people will be added onto this planet. Most of those people will be living in urban centers of 250,000 or more. And we see, you know, a lot of issues focusing around on food equity and access. Do people have access to quality foods? And those that don't, we see, you know, increasing rise of diabetes and other kinds of health effects of that. Transportation is another one. And obviously, clearly the one that has superseded or really becomes what population was for the 1970s, climate change is for the 21st century, as seen as the central environmental issue.
Did Gaylord Nelson link the issues of climate or, let's say, environment and social justice?
Well, he did in the sense, as I mentioned earlier, in terms of really seeing issues around poverty and housing and health as connected to issues of the environment. But one of the things that happens in the 1970s is with the creation of this environmental legislation, this federal environmental legislation that happens, as the environment, if you will, becomes institutionalized within government, and we see the Big Ten organizations like the Wilderness Society and the Sierra Club and the Nature Conservancy and others basically set up lobbying shops in Washington. It just becomes one special interest among many in which Washington bureaucrats are having to deal with. As that happens in the 1970s, the kinds of, I think, issues around social justice and civil rights become less integrated into the environmental movement. And it's really in the 1980s with a really important act that happens in Warren County, North Carolina, where an African-American community fights the dumping of PCBs in their neighborhood. And it leads to the term environmental racism. And we see the rise of the environmental justice movement in the 1980s and 1990s. That environment and social justice really come together in a very, very strong way. And I think now, even if you look at those Big Ten organizations, they cannot move forward in terms of the kind of work they're doing and continue to ignore issues of social justice.
We're going to talk about the 40th Earth Day and what's coming up when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Greg Mittman, and we are talking about Earth Day. Earth Day in its 40th year, and it will take place coming up soon. And there are events here in Madison, and we have information about that by linking to the NelsonEarthDay.net website on our website at University of the Air. So, Greg, tell us about the event here in Madison, the 40th Earth Day celebration.
It's not only the 40th anniversary of Earth Day, it's also the 40th anniversary of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, which was founded in 1970, renamed after Gaylord Nelson in 2002. And we have a lot of exciting events being planned, a number of prominent keynote speakers that will be coming, including Robert Kennedy Jr., founder of the Waterkeeper Alliance, Margaret Atwood, a Canadian writer and novelist, Bill Meadows, who's president of the Wilderness Society, along with a number of other prominent speakers and guests. And it's really designed to both celebrate Earth Day's history and Wisconsin's role in that, and particularly Gaylord Nelson's role. Wisconsin, in many ways, was a pioneer in terms of both environmentalism and environmental legislation. We have a long history, right, of prominent environmental thinkers going back to John Muir and Otto Leopold and obviously Gaylord Nelson. But it, as a state, also largely through Gaylord Nelson's efforts, really became seen as a state pioneering a lot of important legislation that other states would, and the federal government would come on to model.
Margaret Atwood, I'm stuck on that. I've read many of her novels, but in what way is Margaret Atwood somehow part of this Earth Day?
Well, her father was a forest entomologist, and she spent a lot of time in her youth in the Canadian North Woods, a lot of time around ecologists. And if you read her writings, and particularly her science fiction writings, Oryx and Crake, and most recently her latest novel, The Year of the Flood, she has really integrated that into thinking about our environmental future and in a way a kind of ecological dystopia, if you will. And one of the things that's really, I would say, important about addressing environmental issues and is so central to the way in which the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies was founded and continues its work is that the environment really is a very complex problem, and it requires interdisciplinary thinking that is bringing together the arts and the humanities and the natural sciences and social sciences together to really address and solve our environmental issues. And so bringing Margaret Atwood as someone really who brings the perspective of the humanities onto our environmental issues and problems is an important part of the 40th Earth Day anniversary.
How would you compare that first Earth Day with Earth Day 2010? Is this going to involve more than 22 million people, and is it more of an international phenomenon now?
It's certainly more of an international phenomenon. It will not be the kind of galvanizing politically action event as happened at that moment in 1970. It's really quite hard to imagine that happening now. And so, you know, I think we'll see a lot of celebrations throughout that. In Madison, not only will we be doing a series of speakers and events at the Monona Terrace in Madison, we'll also be doing things with the public schools. John Francis will be coming, is a noted Nelson alum who's walked the planet in the name of the environment, and he's going to be taking some school children on a walk throughout Madison. But that kind of really galvanizing moment, I think, is past.
Well, people are aware, at least maybe in that sense, that it did what it was intended to do. And maybe ideally, this kind of awareness of the environment is now much more of an ongoing thing rather than everything focused in one day.
Certainly, you know, one of the things that Nelson really wanted to achieve was really creating that environmental awareness, and environmental education was very important to him. And, you know, certainly that awareness is very much a part, I think, of our society now. One of the things I would say, though, that is a bit different is in the 1960s and early 70s, there was a particularly concern and a critique of American consumption, that we had, you know, Americans had lived through this remarkable decade, couple decades of affluence and an abundance, and were consuming vast amounts of resources.
Disproportionate amount, far out of proportion.
Right. And there was really a critique of that kind of way of life. And I think that in many ways, as the environmental movement became kind of institutionalized within Washington, that critique in a way, in some ways, has become softened, right? And so now what do we see? We see the promotion of green consumerism, right?
As
different, you know, that allows us to feel good about consumption.
We can have it both ways.
We can have it both ways, but it's really not addressing the major kinds of infrastructural issues that Nelson was quite concerned about. He didn't think, for example, gross national product was a good measure of thinking about quality of life and growth. He talked about gross national quality. And we know from studies that just buying more things doesn't necessarily make people more happy in their lives.
It says on your website that there's also going to be an exhibit at the Historical Society or several exhibits. Can you talk about that? What would we see?
The exhibits at the Wisconsin Historical Society, both at its downtown location by the Capitol and then at the Wisconsin Historical Society on Library Mall. The one downtown by the Capitol is really more family-friendly, really organized around Earth Day itself and interpreting the history of Earth Day at that moment in 1970, whereas the exhibits at the Historical Society on Library Mall focus more on Gaylord Nelson's political career and his prominence in terms of the environmental movement.
And if Gaylord Nelson were giving a speech for Earth Day 2010 in Milwaukee, let's take him back there full circle 40 years later, what do you think would be in his speech?
It's an interesting question. Now the word, you know, we use a lot is sustainability in place of environmentalism. And I think there's interesting reasons why that's the case. So I think he would talk a lot about our sustainable future. I think the recent economic crisis the nation has undergone really validates his words about the economy in some ways being a subsidiary of the environment. And I think he would focus on that, the kind of economic crisis and its meaning for environmental legislation and action.
These days, people talk about green jobs and thinking green and so on. Where do you think Gaylord Nelson would be on that?
You know, it's very interesting. Gaylord Nelson started a number of kind of green jobs programs throughout his political career. So in the 1960s, as he was really very involved in the Johnson administration's war on poverty, put forth legislation, didn't pass, but on the, what he called the Constructive Work Act. And I think it was very much shaped by his own involvement in the Works Progress Administration as a youth in terms of using federal programs to put people to work who were unemployed that would benefit the public interest. And so he really saw efforts in terms of creating employment that would really help the environments and people where people lived, worked, and played as important both to environmental and economic recovery.
Well, let's take him back full circle now. Born northern Wisconsin, 1916, the landscape there, and I've seen pictures. The ironic name of Birchwood, Wisconsin, for example, was stumps as far as you could see.
Right.
The time that Gaylord Nelson came along. How is northern Wisconsin, his homeland, different today? And to what extent is that because of Gaylord Nelson?
Well, I mean, if you travel north now, you would see a landscape nothing like the cutover zone in which he kind of grew up in, that it's, you know, repopulated with new forests. The preservation of land along the Lake Superior through the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, we see in many ways a regeneration of that landscape in ways that I think he would be quite delighted by. increasingly we see issues around second homes and water quality and you know, nutrient runoff that happens in terms of those lakes and eutrophication and increasing demand for those areas in terms of tourism that creates other kinds of problems. But I mean, in terms of the restoration of the landscape, it's something that I think he would be quite proud of.
If we look in Congress today, who would be the closest successor to Gaylord Nelson?
Well, I mean, certainly we see the entire Obama administration in a way has really, through the focus on the green jobs, really sees the environment as an important dimension of economic recovery and clean energy as a really important aspect of economic recovery as well. So, I mean, I think I would say in terms of the entire administration's view, but in terms of any single proponent out there on the front lines, I'm not sure.
But there would be many more of those proponents today than there were back in 1970 when Gaylord Nelson got that first Earth Day going?
I would say that one of the things that we see now is that it's actually become a much more partisan issue. And I think that would actually really upset Gaylord Nelson.
But so many other things have too.
Exactly, right. But, you know, the environment isn't a partisan issue. We all depend upon the environment for our life. And it's neither Democrat nor Republican. And if you look at the history of the environmental movement in this country, more lands were created in terms of national forests and national parks by Teddy Roosevelt, a Republican, you know, than and under any other Democratic administration. So that divide hasn't existed really in the history of the environmental movement. And I think the partisanship would be a real dismay to Gaylord Nelson.
Do you think the grassroots origins of Earth Day have been lost a bit? And I mean,
yeah, it's very interesting that it's hard to see where that grassroots movement would come from today. And for example, we don't have a grassroots movement around climate change, right? We don't see it as kind of a galvanizing force that's bringing people en masse. I mean, in some ways it has happened through Bill McKibben's 350.org and some other things, but not, you know, not on the scale that we saw.
It's kind of partisan too, isn't it?
Right.
The whole global warming, climate change issue.
Yes.
Lots of new interest in local food growing though.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think we see really a national debate and discussion happening around the nation's food supply and really concerns about sustainable agricultural and better quality food and access to everyone.
Our guest this hour has been Greg Mittman, Interim Director of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the UW-Madison, and the event, Earth Day 2010. This would be, I guess, actually the 41st Earth Day. There's been one every year, has there, since 1970, so far as we know?
1970, yes.
Then that comes on April 22nd, and Earth Day 2010 can be in its way just as successful as that first one, by the sound of it. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.